Welcome back to another episode of the Stranded Sports Podcast. It's just Tyler Gallo with here with you tonight. And with spring training just around the corner, we decided to hop back in on the train with baseball guests. And today we have a very great baseball guest. Today we have former MLB infielder and 1998 World Series champion Homer Bush. Homer, thanks so much for sitting down with me today.
Hey, Tyler. Thanks for having me.
Of course. All right. So, got to get right started at the beginning. So growing up, you played multiple sports, growing up in East St. Louis in Illinois, and starting at wide receiver in high school and, of course, playing baseball. What do you think stood out about baseball over other sports you played growing up?
Baseball, I had played a lot longer. You know, I had played it, and they would call it youth baseball today. So, but football, I played, I believe, like they call it middle school nowadays. So we call it junior high, like my ninth grade year. Was my first year organized football. And then once I got to high school, I played those 3 years as well. And so when it came down to the decision whether I was going to continue playing baseball or football, you know, in the next chapter of my life, it was pretty easy decision. And plus, I'm not much for physical contact, so football was it was a tough decision.
Right, and you passed up college to pursue the baseball career, and you said that was pretty easy. So playing through the minor leagues, was there ever a moment that you knew that you could make the jump to the MLB?
Well, this is where I say naivete played a huge role, right? Because when I was drafted, I thought that the Padres were just grooming me to be their next second baseman, but after being there for a few years, and I started noticing that there was a different draft every year, and there would be more and more second basemen, and it became a logjam, and it was like, I think I'm going to have to compete. So in the beginning, I really thought they were grooming me, but then I put my competitive hat on and got the job done.
Yeah, and you think having that competitive, those competitive juices flowing as you were out there helped you in the long run?
Oh, no doubt. You know, I tell my son this story all the time that high school football, I believe, prepared me for the competition and the minor leagues, really, because growing up in the inner city, I mean, a lot of talented young players, you know, I competed and won some starting jobs, even in high school, junior high school. So I knew if I just worked hard, kept my nose clean and learned the plays, didn't know how successful I was going to be, but that was some type of success to be had for sure.
Great mindset to have, especially going forward as you got into the upper levels of the minor leagues. So in 1997, which would be the year you'd make your debut, the Padres traded you away. Was it disheartening getting traded before you played into a game, played a game with a team that drafted you? Or do you think, you know, I'm just going to play for whatever team I'm on and take this in stride?
You know, a little bit of both. As you can imagine, I was in AAA. I felt like I was so close. In 96, I had an injury, but I was playing well. In 97, I had gotten off to a good start, and that's when the trade took place. So I felt like, I'm going to a new situation. Yankees just won the World Series. I can't imagine there's going to be a lot of playing time available, you know, from defending world champs. So I said, you know, my agent spoke to me about I was out of options, and he was saying, hey, don't go there and do anything crazy. Just you know, keep doing what you're doing. You're out of options. And if you continue being successful, you'll be in the big league somewhere next year. So it was a lot of moving parts at that time. But I did want to get some time in with the Padres, considering I had spent so much time with that organization.
Right, especially definitely interesting, especially when you're growing up, basically grew up through that organization. So, but moving forward with the Yankees, you did make your debut in 97, and you racked up multiple firsts, including your first game and then your first RBI on your first hit. So how did those moments just feel, especially getting those out of the way?
You know, it felt really good because getting to the major leagues is difficult, but it's kind of the easy part, you know, but getting an opportunity to show that you belong and getting that first hit, you know, it just gives you all kinds of confidence. And, you know, but, you know, I was playing for an organization that was just dominant, right? That was just really good. So confidence was high. And, but to get that first hit and start having some success early on was huge for my confidence going forward.
Right. And you mentioned the dominance of the Yankees in that era. You played around some of the best players in baseball. What was it like, especially learning from some of these guys?
Hey, you know, what was really cool was that my oldest brother, who introduced me to baseball, you know, those are some of his childhood idols: Daryl Strawberry, Tim Raines, Chili Davis. You know, so when I got an opportunity to play with the, alongside those guys, I mean, he thought that was just the coolest thing ever. So, there's just so many things that was just exciting about my major league career, considering baseball had been a huge part of my family for years. So, it was just a ton of things to be excited about.
Right. And playing in the infield, obviously you got to play around Derek Jeter. Did he ever mentor you? And what was that sort of like, learning from one of the best to ever do it?
You know, it's amazing because, remember, Derek was just, he was still young. So he was trying to feel his way. Right. But he was having some success. So we were just trying to figure this thing out on the fly. And, but you know, 20 years later, he's probably one of the best shortstops to play the game. So, but at that time, I mean, we were just, young players, just trying to have some success.
Right. And so moving forward, you got through your first season, and then in 98 was pretty much better. You hit your first major league home run that season off of a knuckleballer and Steve Sparks. How did it feel to get the first home run on the board first off? Because you looked like you were nonchalant rounding the bases in the clip, but did it feel just great on the inside?
Oh, absolutely. When I went from first to second, I remember saying to myself, young man, you just hit your first major league home run. So I was really pumped. And I'll tell you what was really cool about that home run was that I believe we hadn't scored a run in like 21 innings, which was rare for that team. And it was the second game with doubleheader, and I was in the clubhouse, and Joe came up to me and said, hey, you're in at second, you know, be ready. And then to spark the team like that, to not only did we get on the board, but we also had taken the lead for the first time in quite some time as well. So, you know, just contributing after, you know, not playing for, gosh, five, six games in a row. So that was a pretty cool feeling.
Right. And it was off a knuckleballer and Steve Sparks, and you had another pretty big knuckleballer in the AL East in a few years in Tim Wakefield. Was the adjustment ever different for a knuckleball pitcher? Was it sort of the same as any other pitcher you'd face?
Oh, gosh, I hated facing knuckleballers. Man, that ball is dancing around so much. And if it was windy on a windy day when they were pitching, oh, it made it even more difficult. So, knuckleballers were not my favorite by no means. I just got lucky for sure.
Definitely tough to get in against one of those pitches, especially moving all over the place. Growing up, I was a Mets fan, so I saw R.A. Dickey during his Cy Young years, and that was just crazy. So in that 98 season, obviously the Yankees made the run of the World Series and won. What was it like being on the postseason roster, especially with the packed Yankee Stadium atmosphere and then contributing to getting a ring?
Really cool because like each step of the way, I didn't know if it was going to be on the postseason roster, first of all, from go, and then to make that, and then just continue on throughout the whole postseason, and kind of I started the season opener, never went down to the minor leagues, and played all the way through the postseason. Huge accomplishment, extremely difficult to do, especially on a team like the Yankees where you're expected to win, and they just had a ton of talent they could have chosen from. So I mean, that was just an amazing accomplishment, you know, for myself, big time.
Right. Yeah, definitely. That's definitely a huge dream for anybody playing baseball growing up. And you faced off against one of the best hitters to ever do it, Tony Gwynn. Did you ever like talk to him, or did you ever meet the guy, especially going up in the Padres organization?
Absolutely. All the time, because I went to big league camp like 3 years in a row. I got an opportunity to spend some disabled time in the major league. So I spent, gosh, 3-4 months around him. And I also would go there in the winter and train sometimes. So I spent a ton of time with Tony Gwynn and learned a lot from him. I always tell my son, I learned a lot about video analysis from Tony Gwynn. He was one of the first to get into video and at-bats and looking at them and give me some cues to look for. So I learned a ton from him.
Right, definitely a great mentor to have, especially, you know, growing up with Derek Jeter as well as Tony Gwynn. Those are two of the best players to do it with, so that's awesome. So after that season, traded to Toronto for David Wells, and to feel sort of a youth movement in Toronto in that era. I know they love their sports in Toronto. We've seen it a lot over these last couple of years, but what was it like to get into a team like that where the attendance wasn't as big as it was in sort of the late 2010s?
Well, first of all, I was excited to get an opportunity to play every day. Yeah. So just like you were saying, it was like a youth movement. Everybody's just trying to learn, get better, have some success, and get an opportunity to play again the next season. For me, I always felt like we were chasing the fan base attendance of the early 90s. And that's all they spoke about was how to get 50,000 people all in the streets. So, you know, I was hoping we can get back to those winning ways, and maybe not fully, but, you know, at least get some momentum. And the Jays were trying to replace Roberto Alomar, some big shoes to fill. You know, he's definitely one of the best to do it at that position. So there were some moving parts that I was focusing on outside of the game, but definitely want to increase the fan base for sure.
Right. And, you know, going from playing on, you know, regular grass to turf must have been a pretty interesting adjustment, especially with the funky bounces that could take off turf. Was the adjustment hard for you, or was it sort of just, you know what, this is baseball, I'm going to play it and do as well as I can?
Yeah, like you said, just it's baseball. I'm going to adjust to it and do what I can. But more importantly, I learned how to use it to my advantage, hit the ball extremely hard on the ground, you know, make the infielders move to the right, to the left, and, you know, just run as fast as I could to first base. So, I did learn how to play on turf where it benefited my game.
Right. And you mentioned, you know, playing every day in Toronto. In that season, you had a career year, batting .320, hitting 5 home runs, 55 RBI. What do you think fueled your success during that season, in addition to getting to play every day?
Learning how to hit the off speed and breaking pitches. You know, once I had gotten off to a halfway decent start, pitchers had taken notice that I was a good fastball hitter. So I was going to have to be able to hit sliders, curveballs in order to continue that success. So, you know, and caught some breaks along the way. Absolutely. I had some good coaches. Sarge, Gary Matthews Sr. was my hitting coach, and he was, you know, instrumental on keeping my confidence high when, you know, things weren't going that well. And, you know, he taught me some things about keeping the bat in the zone, driving the ball the up the way, staying up the middle the other way. So it was a lot of people that contributed to my success that season big time.
Definitely good to have help surrounding you, especially in Gary Matthews Sr. and stuff like that. So that year you stole 32 bases as well. So with the art of the stolen base sort of dying out in baseball, was how much strategy went into deciding when to run and sort of when to pick, when to jump and sort of stuff like that?
You know, for me, it was, I was max lead once the leg raised go. So I would run first pitch, second pitch. It didn't matter. I just felt invincible, right? I felt like, man, I could outrun the ball. You know, I was, like I say, I was just young and just out of control. So stolen bases for me was my way to get the crowd going, get a big lead. If they picked over, just dive back. At that time, and this is no knock on pitchers, but pitchers are far more athletic now than they were back then. Back then, power pitching was just drive the lower half down. So it was really easy to, steal bases, because now they're so, with all the pitching data, they're able to hold runners a little bit more than in the past.
Yeah, it's almost sort of crazy, like, watching it growing up, how crazy it was to see, like, guys steal, like, 60-plus bases, and now that's pretty much unheard of in this day and age in baseball. So over the course of that course of a couple seasons in Toronto, 2002, you got released by Toronto but then got picked up by Miami – or Florida, excuse me. Was that – and having to move all the way down there, was that tough on you mentally, or once again, was it just, I'm going to play for whatever team I'm on and go out there and do my best?
So going to Miami, was that tough? No chance at all. No, I tell you what, even though my career had taken a hit, because nobody wants to get released, but man, if you're going to get released, go to Miami, right? Like, man.
Right.
But no, it was a tough time for me because sabermetrics had come into play, and I didn't walk a lot. They're big on-base people, right? So say, for instance, you know, I would hit I hit 300 the year before, but my on-base percentage was 330, 340. So the way Moneyball worked was they can pay a young man who walked to get on base $1 as opposed to paying me $2 because I got on with the bat. So that's what hurt my career. I didn't walk enough, not that I couldn't hit. So I kind of understood the business. The Blue Jays were looking to go in a different direction. So, and I was getting kind of expensive for that model. So I totally understood that side of the business. And I mean, I did, at least I did try to walk more you know, that became kind of the goal of the organization, but it just wasn't for me. But going to Miami was huge. There again, another young team that was exciting, fun to watch. And so it was all right for me and my family.
Right. And in Toronto, you got to play with one of my favorite players growing up in Carlos Delgado. Is it true that he had a notebook writing down to watch like every pitcher and stuff like that? Was that true? Cause I've heard about that so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, big time student of the game. Great to be around. Very intelligent young man. And man, can he hit the ball a long ways? Yeah.
That's awesome. So over the next few seasons, you'd battle injuries, including having to sit out the entire 2003 season. Was that tough on you at all, having to sit out and watch your teammates play?
Yeah, it was tough because I didn't know if I was going to be able to continue my career. It was thought to be arthritis in the hip joints. And, you know, it didn't play well for a guy who needs to steal bases, right? So I actually got with a trainer, worked really hard in 03, and I came back in 04.
Yeah, and coming back must have been great. And in 2004, you came full circle and rejoining the Yankees, but then hung them up in 2005. Was it hard to, like, retire? Was that decision weighing on you at all, or was it just, you know, they weren't playing me enough, and I think it's just time?
That's exactly what happened. And then a young man by the name of Robinson Cano was starting to take off. And it was like, man, there was just not a whole lot of at-bats to be had. And I had done the whole AAA thing, gosh, almost, you know, 8 years prior. And I just didn't want to go back to those days. So I felt it was time for me to go home, raise my family, and, man, get on with my life.
Yeah. And so following your career, Yankees still kept you in touch. I mean, you played an old-timers day. What was it like to go back and see some of your old teammates as well as have a fun day of baseball at Yankee Stadium?
You know, it was definitely one of the highlights of my year, you know, every year after I retired, because, you know, I got an opportunity to hear the stories from some of the you know, the older, you know, living Yankees. And it was just like awesome. And you know, you find yourself doing two and three events a year with some of those guys, and man, your families get close. And it was, I'm glad I did get into the old timers day at a young age, because, you know, I have so many memories and so many friends from those experiences. It's actually pretty cool.
Yeah, definitely cool to watch on TV too. So throughout your career, you've played obviously in a ton of places, on the road and at home as well. Was there a stadium that was your favorite other than the ones that you would play at home?
Well, quite naturally, all the ones I had success at. Those were my favorites. But I love going to Anaheim. Love the West Coast. I love playing in Texas. The old Tiger Stadium, old Yankee Stadium. Hated going to Boston, though. I could not do well in that place for nothing. But just those are just to name a few. Those, you know, I had a ton of success in Texas.
Yeah, right. And so we talked about, you know, you playing with Derek Jeter and Carlos Delgado, guys like that. But is there another teammate that stood out as your guy, a guy that was your favorite or one of your best friends as you moved up the ranks into the MLB?
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, dude, Shannon Stewart was a freak of an athlete. He was just, man, he was awesome to be around, good dude. Tim Raines, when I was with the Yankees, oh, wow, amazing individual. Man, you would never have thought that he was a Hall of Famer the way he treated everybody. He was always upbeat, having fun. But Shannon Stewart and I were pretty close for years. And, you know, once you start having kids and get married, it's not enough hours in the day. So, but I'd say those are two of my favorites.
Right. Definitely cool to have some of those guys that have been around the block a little bit, to sort of mentor you and help you with the nuances of the game. So that's pretty cool. So you mentioned your son earlier in the podcast, but how have you transferred your baseball knowledge on your son? Because I know he's getting into the sort of college age level of baseball.
You know, just talk to him about how to handle failure in the game of baseball. You know, everybody know how to deal with success. But, you know, when the game is not you know, it doesn't seem to be fair, like, you know, find ways to get it done. And, but more importantly, know the kind of player you are, you know, don't be a guy that's supposed to be a high on base guy, but you're trying to hit home runs or vice versa. So once you understand the dynamics of the game, know the type of player you are, then I think you can go out, put a game plan together and, you know, try to execute and have as much success as possible. But just whatever you do, don't be a blank canvas. Don't be out there just not knowing what you're striving for, what's the goal. That is going to make for a terrible experience.
Right. Good to instill confidence in him, especially as he gets to the sort of, I mean, in this day and age with the mental health and all that coming to the forefront, that's definitely a big thing. But was that sort of just, was it a problem as much as it is now back then, like athletes seeing, you know, bad reviews in the newspaper or just getting ripped on by reporters? Was that tough on anybody that you played with?
You know, I would say we dealt with it a lot better because it seemed to be the norm. Right. Like, man, and I would imagine in some cases people wouldn't want to come forward because it may have seemed weak. One thing I can say is, man, playing the major leagues is one of the most stressful and, you know, difficult things I've ever tried to accomplish in my life. And so I know the stress was there for tons of players. It's just, I just feel like, man, we just handled it differently because it seemed like, This is just part of the process. Deal with it. And but today it's good to see you know, players speaking up, trying to talk about it and, you know, lend some type of, you know, comfort to people that's going through it because it is difficult, no doubt.
Right. What do you think the one thing, or is there anything that stands out to you as the biggest change since from when you played as to seeing baseball now as it's being played out?
You know, the whole home run thing, man, that is so weird to me. It's like, man, it's the most difficult result to accomplish in baseball. And that seems to be the goal. And I never could grasp that concept because it's such an inefficient goal. Like you gotta something like 10 or 12 fly balls to get one home run. So, man, there's a lot of routine outs being made. So, you know, and what the data is telling us is that if you're not getting, you know, more offense some type of way before you get to that, you know, one home run average per, I don't know, like 12 fly balls, like, man, you're going to have a game that's not fun to watch and fun to be around, you know? So that's the one thing that totally took me by surprise when, you know, a lot of teams start focusing on home runs. That was really weird to me.
Yeah, definitely interesting to watch the fly ball revolution sort of take form over these last couple of years. So one thing you did that I really enjoyed when I looked it up was that you wrote a book, Hitting Low in the Zone, which what inspired you to write this? And can you give listeners sort of a premise of what the book is about so they could know?
Sure. So when my career was impacted by Moneyball and big data, so I got into it because I didn't want for my son's inability to not draw walks hurt his career. So, I mean, that was easy to figure out, actually. Like, they're the top, middle, bottom zones. Well, the middle of the zone, you're not going to walk there. So you can only walk at the top or the bottom. The problem is 50% of the pitches are at the bottom. So your focus needs to be on the bottom of the zone and over the plate. The top of the zone only gets high fastballs, which is difficult. You lay off of that to try to get ahead or assist with drawing a walk, but you need to be able to be in position to not only make good decisions on pitches low and over the middle of the plate, you need to be able to move them efficiently because it impacted how many hits you would get, how many walks you would get, because it seemed like the high fastball was literally take your attention away from the middle of the plate and below the zone where pitchers were very comfortable. So when, you know, year in and year out, when you look at the data as a hitter, you've got to be able to hit outside of the strike zone first and then, you know, protect over the middle of the plate. Because at the end of the day, they're only going to throw about 40% of pitches in the strike zone. But when you subtract first pitch takes, you get caught looking 3-1, 3-2 takes to try to draw walks. I mean, you're really trying to have a successful season on about 20-some percent of pitches thrown in the strike zone as a first option. It makes no sense. So what the data shows is, like, guys like Mike Trout, Arenado, they get tons of success below the strike zone and over the middle of the plate, and they have low swing rates on high fastballs.
Right. Awesome. Definitely good knowledge to have as players come up and try to, you know, hit these fly balls, but also get make a living in the MLB. So that's pretty cool. But as we're sort of drawing to a close here, I know we mentioned the book, but if there's anything else that you'd like to shout out or plug right now, now is your time to do it.
No, I appreciate it, man. I'll tell you what, just, man, just, you know, if your listeners can go to hitlowinthezone.com, take a look at the book and the data and the analysis. Man, I think it's fun. It's cool. The one thing I can say about my hitting philosophy is that you don't have to be tall. You don't have to be fast. You don't have to be, you know, you can be who you are. You just need a little bat control. And that's what baseball has always been about forever. And, you know, learn how to position yourself to attack those pitches and move those pitches efficiently and proficiently. You'll be fine.
Awesome. Well, I'll definitely be paying a visit to the website pretty soon after this. But once again, this has been the Stranded Sports Podcast. Homer, thank you so much for sitting down today. For all your listeners out, you can follow him on Twitter at Bush Homer. And yeah, definitely go to hittinglowinthezone.com. Thanks again, Homer.
All right. Thanks for having time. Be well.
All right. We will see you guys next week. We'll be right back.